And welcome to this edition of In Tune with Opera Philadelphia. My name is Mike Bolton. I'm the VP of Community Initiatives, and we are thrilled to be here with the part of the creative team behind our reimagining of Poulenc and his La Voix Humaine, Nikita Pa. We're here with the wonderful soprano Patricia Rossette, who stars as Elle, and James Darra, who is our phenomenal director. You may remember his work if you were here two seasons ago with the breathtaking and devastating Breaking of the Waves, and we're thrilled to have him back again for this double bill of sorts, Nikita Pa.
Yeah, less of a double bill, actually.
Okay.
I think. I don't like thinking of it as a double bill, because a double bill sometimes is like two complete works totally separated out, right? It's one half that often is in completely different world or even musical styles. People pair different composers together. And our evening is all Poulenc. It's all his music and all poems and poetry of people that he either set, you know, other things from Apollinaire, who he certainly used his text for Mamel, his other opera, and then Cocteau, certainly, who wrote La Voix. We've used some of his other things in the first half. And I think of it more as an evening in which there is an extended Cocteau universe in the first half that sets up the opera in the second half. So we're not over-contextualizing it or changing it. We're just framing it in the space in a way that gets you ready for the opera, which we haven't touched. We haven't changed that.
So I sort of teased this question out to you guys before we started recording, but just to sort of preface this, some of my favorite evenings in the theater have been around Poulenc.
Cool.
Whether it was Mamel, whether it was Dialogues. When you think of Poulenc, what do you think of?
As I was saying,
you should answer that. Yeah, right now.
I mean, he. When I think of Poulenc, I think of theater, because he really did write theatrically riveting musical drama, really, and that's always been my experience. I mean, I've participated in Dialogues, what I've done 7 different productions and various, and as Blanche and then as Lidwen, and it's just the richness is so, it seems never ending, that you can really dig in and the interpretive palette from which you can draw what he gives you is great, and the what our ear hears so informs what the words say, and it just it's rich, and there's an innate complexity, yet sometimes it's musically set to such a simple accompaniment, and it's just I mean, we won't be hearing an orchestra with this obviously because of this sort of new view and creation, but his orchestration is also something that is phenomenal in painting the whole evening in the picture and the storytelling.
Yeah. James?
I think that it makes me think of certain images and things. I think a lot of the music, the operas, I'm always amazed that each opera is completely different. He kind of wrote one of each style, right? And I find the music too, and the song cycles, some of which we're using in the first half, are incredibly able to paint with sound. And to me, there's a lot of physical, both movement and a richness of imagery that comes to mind when you hear these sort of things, whether it's literally tied to the text of whatever the art song is, but also just this kind of general feeling. I think we're kind of learning in both of the halves of the evening to move in with thought in Poulenc time. Like, you know, his thought time is slightly different than real time, but real and makes sense, but it's its own universe.
So we are calling this a reimagined La Voix Humaine. What does that mean?
We've been saying the real title should have been Sorry, Wrong Number. And how we can reimagine it. I mean, I think the reimagining is what I said, is that and I've been telling this to people because they ask about the project, and I said at face value, what I don't want it to be is somehow it becomes that either Pat Rossette and James Darra, or Pat and James and Chris Allen, thought that they had to completely change Poulenc in order to make it better. And we have not touched La Voix at all.
The score is
the score is exactly what it is. It's exactly what he wrote. And what I was interested in is there a way to take other things that Poulenc wrote in terms of art song and also some of the poems of, you know, either Cocteau, you know, or the Apollinaire poems, and can we create something that gives us that world? Can we create a world? Some of it was dictated also, frankly, by the TLA and the space. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, Opera Philadelphia wanted to do this in an intimate setting. They didn't want to do it in a 900-seat theater. And, you know, the orchestration is fantastic, but I actually don't think doing it with piano is a relegation of the piece. Mm-mm. I don't think that somehow the orchestra is somehow better, or you certainly, it's a different experience. It's a different oral experience. It's much bigger. It's much more operatic in like a traditional sense, I would say. And there's something that we've been discovering in the room since Chris is playing the piano. The solo voice of Pat with the solo voice of the piano somehow is very poetically poignant in an intimate setting like the TLA.
Well, and I mean, so the obvious, the context of the piece is the thing that's reimagined. We're not in her boudoir. We're in a different space. But everything still, you can be true to everything in the score and what she's saying, and you don't have to sort of have a leap of faith in terms of literal meaning. And what's interesting is this piece is so endlessly rich and aggravating simultaneously, because there are little short responses to what's being said on the telephone. The audience will never have the benefit of hearing those specifics. So the richness, interpretively, of finding what that is and what that means and mm-hmm. how that affects her, is it's truly endless. James and I were talking. We could be rehearsing this literally for a year, for 6 days a week, and I think you'd still find new ways to read this line or that line. So the context of it is really, really wide open, and it's a massive responsibility.
So how does that interpretively then, how does that then make your relationship with Chris, the pianist, that much more intimate and special musically as well as dramatically?
Well, because Chris is there and he is visible to, you know, practically speaking, but we're not playing it as though she can see him or that he's in the room.
She has to be alone.
To be alone for this piece. That's something I think that's built into the piece. I think the piece is distorted if it were visually any kind of a duet or interactive situation. We interact with someone, we can't hear the other half of that conversation. We have to glean it from how she listens and how she responds, in various ways. But what we have is Chris is there, and the music, as James was saying, that there's something about doing this with piano instead of with orchestra that is more pliable and applicable in this context, in my view. And it has a really interesting back and forth, so that we can believe that's his voice. And it's not like Chris is over there and I ever act like I see him. And that sort of creates a very interesting, I think it creates something interesting visually and orally. Mm-hmm, and James and I both have a similar aesthetic, just generally speaking, of letting ambiguity be part of the storytelling of the evening. We so often just spell everything out, and it's just, you know, we draw the conclusions.
Here's what to think about every single moment.
This is a 20-minute sitcom. We have to have beginning, middle, and an end.
What does that mean? Yeah. What happened? I don't understand the ending.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's
wonderful to do that, but not in a bad way. You don't have to be like, what was that?
Yeah.
But it's more what they find and discover in that storytelling. And people, you know what? This art form, it allows us to be transported, but also to be transported from our own daily stories, from our own life stories. Mm-hmm. We want to see our lives up there in one form or fashion. We want some sort of a cathartic experience.
Something we can identify
with. And so when people bring a different and identify different moments in different ways, that's exactly what's happening in my view. And I think that's when this art form and any art form and performance art form is at its richest, when everyone is involving themselves in that fashion. Thank you.
So I've been hearing all sorts of amazing things, that everyone's having a great time, the energy in the room is amazing, you know, it's really been such a collaborative effort.
Yeah, yeah. Considering the content of Leroy Men, we've been laughing a lot.
Yeah.
Which I think is essential.
The humor has been very, very forward placed. Very, very much so. Very much so.
What is it like to work with each other? And have you worked together before?
No, that's what's amazing. No. This is our first thing. Yeah. And I mean, we have had, I think before we arrived, we had talked on the phone twice. But I feel like the first time we talked, we both kind of came at it in that way of like, well, we're going to see. You know, there's just that thing of you don't know where something's going to land. And not that from a negative place, just of like, I have no idea, you know, what this is going to be like. And the things that she said she was interested in were all the things that I had on my list of things that I wanted to talk to her about. And then I said something and she's like, well, I was thinking exactly the same thing for the end. And it just meant that the whole process has been about what is the best way to do this. And also, I mean, you know, I feel like at a certain point, a director's job is to be a barometer and a taste, you know, barometer for whoever's performing. And something like Lavoie lives or dies with her. I can give her as many ideas or concepts, and I could say, you know, I could play the auteur card and I have this concept that you're never on the phone and whatever.
And a big,
and, you know, a big giant couch, you know, it's like, and you never move. But actually, what's great is that I think because we were able to talk and because we kind of knew of each other, you know, in a way before coming here, I have never felt for one instant that I can't just be honest, and her the same way.
Right.
If I do something and she's like, it's just, you just instantly begin a process getting around all of that first day of school
stuff. There's none of the crap. It's about the real work. And I think we both are so adhered to the actual real process. And, and for me, something James has instilled in me is a trust that not to sound untrusting, but that's something that in my almost 30 years in this profession, that is something that always has been something that must be earned. And I don't say that out of ego or any sort of overinflated self-importance. I say that out of like a true commitment to the integrity of what the art form is. I have to believe it on some level. If I can't find it in myself, give me more to believe it. And because for me, that's what's fun, is exploring another way to tell that story, something else. I mean, I don't want to just bring my own sensibilities to everything. That'll be unnecessarily limited. So that's what's been really wonderful and fun and really just terrific about working with James.
Sorry, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, and it's also been great because I'm basically, as a director, I'm in these kind of half-day situations where I only spend half my day with Pat and I spend the other half of the day with everybody else. And what's been interesting is, like I was saying, we haven't altered Lavoie, but we've done things in the first half and been discovering things in the first half that actually have led me to ideas, whether they're directly related or not. Something will happen and then I'll say, oh, here's how we make sense of this moment. Or, you know, one of the woman in the first half drinks out of a glass, and I said, you find that, and it fuels this whole section of Lavoie where she's clearly paranoid about what he's doing. You know, because she's like, what, you clearly were here, and why is there women's lipstick on this glass, you know? And it's, that's all interior. She never says that in the piece, but it's just these little details that I think it's been interesting, because I feel like I'm always just like, I'm not like giving her all these things, you know, she's like, okay, you know, what else is it? But the piece is so psychological and so, it's so much about an actor and singing actor's ability to credibly and believably manufacture interior thought that draws you as an audience in.
And the thing is, and I've been saying this, this piece, I'm not one to be stage frighty or anything that, but this piece is such a massive interpretive responsibility, and it has to be something that I can drive from beginning to end for the entire night. I don't have, mm-hmm. there's not a scene change.
She was telling Chris, it's bigger than Butterfly slightly, right?
If you put the minutes, if you have to, you know, when you run mm-hmm. through a role, it's longer than Butterfly. I mean, wow. it's not the difference, same vocal treatment all the way through as Butterfly, but it's still, but concentration, there, you know, there's not another person having a moment singing. There's not a duet. There's not an interaction. It all has to be
you're never off.
Driven right. by, and so it's that is massive. And you know, we're fried after every single rehearsal but we're also digging in deep mm-hmm. and really, but it's also trying to just absolutely digest everything so that it can mm-hmm. logically flow. And Poulenc wrote a very complex. Dramaturgically complex piece because it's certain mm-hmm. moments pop and frankly come out of nowhere in terms of storytelling and text mm-hmm. and then go nowhere.
Right.
So giving them a
like
reason,
life.
Like yeah. And so it's really it's yeah. And so it's that's a challenge that I find just really monumental with this piece that I relish, but it keeps me up nights.
I hope not too much.
That's okay. I don't go on till like 10-something.
She has plenty of time.
You're right. So you mentioned acting. You mentioned acting.
Yeah.
There's another component to this production that is very specific to acting and really examining some of those interior thoughts through film. Mm-hmm. Do we want to talk about that?
Yeah.
Do we not want to talk about that?
No, we can talk. No, I think I love talking about that. I mean,
because that's one of the real initial concepts.
The
for this
the initial concept was that I have an interest in what this piece specifically, also what we're doing with the prologue, the way that we can create a universe and a world, and not just film a staged production. Mm-hmm. I have no interest in another film of a stage theater live experience, and I knew that Pat had done several films and operatic films and had that experience. And it was kind of around the time that they told me she would be working on this. David Devan, mm-hmm. president of Opera Philadelphia, also said, you know, what's something else we can do? Like, what does this look like? Why do Levoimen now? And I said, I think there's a way we have an incredibly rich theatrical experience with this piece. And that we, because we are in a unique venue for the piece, like Pat said, it's not set in her bedroom. We're not creating a proscenium mm-hmm. set. There's not an orchestra pit. All the operatic conventions in a way are gone from in that sense, production-wise. And we're in a world that is a set decoration. We're in a created world, a universe that's full 360 degrees. And the staging is all over the entire room. So we started talking about... really then thinking, is there a way, because of the nature of the piece, which I find really actually quite avant-garde as like a creation, I don't think there's very much domestic about it. I think it's real emotion and real, the way that it's constructed is actually kind of audacious, that you never hear anything that he's saying. And it just made me think that there's a way to imagine how opera and art film overlap. And I mean specifically art film, not necessarily like mm-hmm. blockbuster narrative mm-hmm. film, because mm-hmm. the narrative of Levoix is kind of fractured. And so we kind of thought of it in that way of once we do this live experience, everyone in Philadelphia in the festival has an experience of it live, but that we find a way to create a merger of art film and opera that I feel like could be really thrilling and that I haven't seen. And it was great because the designers, most of whom have worked in film and TV, got completely enthused about that idea. And David Devan, to his credit, was like, and we will do this, you know? And they have put things in motion to make that happen. I think we are very glad we are not trying to film while we're doing the live show.
Yeah. Now that we're in it, I knew it's an ambitious schedule anyway to do this back to back, which I do twice, and this is it's an ambitious schedule just on a vocal energy.
Two nights in a row, yeah.
And but then adding the filming, but you know, I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want
to
remove myself from the project. But it's just
also
just to be
exhausting.
It's
exhausting in a different way, and also, I think the first day we were talking about this, Pat said to me, like, I don't want to lip sync this. It's so false. And the whole idea of filming this is to create a kind of visceral truth. And mm-hmm. that has to be, she's like, I'll do better if I sing it. And mm-hmm. so, mm-hmm. You know, so we're in the phase of sorting out when we come back and coalesce all of those things together. But a lot of that's already in motion, and I'm excited about what, you know, what we've found thus far and how we adapt mm-hmm. this and kind of create a lot of new material and a living document of the piece that can also show us things that you don't get in a live show.
Right.
There's things down in the design of props and little things that have, you know, track through the piece, to just little things that Pat's doing on stage, of the way she touches a certain prop or certain things mm-hmm. that you'll certainly feel those live as a performance, but film can show those things in a way that we can't, you know, when we're 30 feet away. So I'm excited about that part of it.
Awesome. I'm going to read a quote from a biography on Francis Poulenc by Benjamin Ivory, where he talks specifically about the title. Although the title La Voix Humaine is sometimes taken in a grandiose way as representing all humanity, it was meant in a specific sense. Elle explains that when a person is reduced by the telephone to only a human voice, any cruelty is possible.
It's like road rage. We've never behaved like that to someone in person. You know, no, you think of when you have some sort of physical apparatus that puts between you and the other person, we don't behave that way. We're hopefully won't start behaving that way.
Right.
I think there's something to that. I mean, there's you know, just think of on any specific possibility, you know, someone sitting there on the phone, you know, rolling their eyes or something. You would never do that if you didn't want that person to know what you were thinking. The idea of, you know, double entendre doesn't describe it even well enough. I mean, there's just so many possibilities of, and we do that all the time in life, and I think this represents that more,
mm-hmm.
more clearly. But it does turn me into a one-armed actress for 45 minutes. Because I have a phone in my hand.
They actually gave me a prop phone sometimes, because I'll ask her to do things. And so I've started holding a phone, because it really changes what you can do. You only have one hand.
You have your one arm. No, and you're sitting there, and then at the beginning, James is sitting there with two hands and going like this. And I said, so we're doing this with the Bluetooth? What's happening?
Right.
Because, but
is there a speakerphone?
You've got to put you on speaker. Yeah. No, but so you, when you're doing that, and you can't, you can put the phone in, but you can't really sing a 45-minute piece, or you perhaps shouldn't the whole time like this. So there are moments you can do that, but basically you have to figure that out, and it does feel limiting, but it's part of it. It's sort of how she's sort of tethered to this emotional experience.
Yes.
Or is she tethered?
Right.
That tomorrow's rehearsal.
Yeah.
Anything else you guys want to talk about with this piece or the prologue or the first part of it? I don't want to call it a prologue.
Yeah. You are calling it a prologue.
I'm calling it a prologue because I think it's important to set up that it is not a separate story that has nothing to do with mm-hmm. what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And I'm not I'm providing some context, but I'm more creating a world in which the aftermath of that world sets the scene for La Voix.
It gives context that one does not usually have for this mm-hmm. piece.
Yes.
It really does.
Because there are actors, there's a scene.
Well, but it gives a physical context.
Right.
Like James was saying, the lipstick on the glass.
Yes.
And the audience has experienced what that world has been. And so then it makes sense. It's not gratuitous that we're deciding to do this not in her boudoir, but in this space. It gives it an anchor, in my opinion.
We had to make sense of the fact that we were in the TLA doing La Voix, and there's an intimacy to everything that she does and says that we had to make sense of that as who have been the people in this space and who might this person be on the phone. I mean, the banal sort of obvious thing would be you stage a whole first half in which you meet the guy and you see everything the guy's doing while she's on the phone with him or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not doing that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the person that, you know, there's one other singer in the prologue. And so I've even seen people say like, you know, that's the other person on the other end of the line. And it's like, well, actually our process kind of evolved beyond that. I think that was like really obvious. And the process took us down this completely other journey that's in... I'm not giving it away, but it took us down a different journey. And the first half is in the Cocteau universe. So there's two characters that actually come from one of his other plays, have sort of by chance met some of our other characters, and we've kind of created this thing where you believe, you know, in the way that people have like fan fiction and stuff, you believe that we're in Paris and we're in this kind of cocktail world. And so certainly she's at home, and she's certainly the woman that he wrote in Le Voix is a character in that world and happens to overlap with other people that we've added to the beginning. So it's kind of like very operatic, expensive fan fiction.
Bizarre tangent. So I'm watching you listen to him.
Yeah.
And the look on your face is so beautiful. You're listening intently.
I love
him. No, there's a real respect and admiration, and that idea of trust, even just sitting here listening to him, definitely comes through, because there's clearly the energies are aligined in such a beautiful way.
I think we completely trust each other. I completely trust her.
We do. Well, that's a lovely thing to say.
I have to say also, I think we... completely. I had never worked with Christopher Allen, who's our music director and is playing the piano all night. He's the only person who tracks through both the scenes and is working really hard in every rehearsal. And Pat and Chris have worked together, and I've known him for a little bit, but this is the first time all three of us coming together here. It actually feels like we've done shows together before. Think, right?
It does.
It's not in an artificial way.
It's been a little over a week, but it's
almost two.
Two, actually. But it's not in any artificial way, but I mean, we've been able to really we have similar senses of humor, which for me is very important to a creative process.
Yes.
And you know, that helps the creative process, and there's never a moment where James is like, okay, come on, let's concentrate. You know, it's something you keep control and command of the room by your collaborative nature. You know, it's not so often sometimes it's somehow a hierarchy sometimes gets put in place, and you're just like, what do you do? Because for me, everyone, I don't care who you are, you're my colleague. I don't care if you're the, you know, new 20-year-old, and I don't care if you're the most famous conductor or director in the world, you're my colleague, and I yours,
and we have to,
and
make
I'm
something.
Only interested in the work on that level. And you know, sometimes that's not that exists, but also we've watched a lot of the same movies, and we quote those lines.
Which really helps.
So
it's an ongoing game to see how many pop culture references we can make in a single
session.
You
also like my sound effects.
Yes. She's also very good at sound effects.
Really?
Which I feel like for a podcast.
Wait, you got to do it.
Okay, all right. So, like, you know, the movie Ghost, when the people that have passed move through the like the train or something like that, there's that sound that. And so that
it's so good. I can't even do it.
But there's also, I don't know, but there's a moment that at the very beginning where I did it. So it's one of these moments. I like a ghost, like, and he said, "Yes." So yes. We, you know,
we have our cartoon moments. Yeah, where she...
exactly. No, it's been really fun.
Good. Yeah. So any sound effects you hear in the show, though it may seem like it's the sound design, it's actually Pat's back.
Exactly.
She's also a Foley artist. She's back behind the set in the prologue making all the rain sounds and everything. Yeah.
Exactly.
Just with a microphone.
Exactly.
She's right there.
You know.
The doors opening and slamming. Yeah. It's
really good. Oh. Well, it has been a real pleasure to talk to you guys, and I'm crazy excited about this production.
Yeah, it's
really
fun.
We are too. Thank you. The pleasure is ours.
It's really fun. It gets into some weird, if you've ever wanted to go to a Paris nightclub in 1980, you'll have a fun time.
And if you don't have your tickets, you have to get tickets to this. Tickets are available on our website at operaphila.org or by calling 215-732-8400.
It's not a huge venue. Chop, chop.
Less than 300 seats.
I think something like that. That's essential. Everybody should. They'll be.
And when's the next time you're going to get to see Patricia Sett in a James Darrow production of Le Voix Humaine in such an intimate space?
Truly, this is a unique thing.
Yeah.
Although we are taking it on the road, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a big van.
It'll be a school tour.
We have a van down by the river.
It has your face on the side of it. Aren't we
a face? Yeah. No, it has a phone on one side.
It has a phone on one side and the face of Matt on the other. It's a big tour bus. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're all about taste in class here.
Yeah.
And scene.